Hello everyone, this is Brian McClanahan again, and today we're going to talk about the political crisis of the 1850s. Now, that title I actually stole from a very influential book by a guy named Michael Holt. And essentially what we are saying here is that the 1850s is nothing more than a political crisis precipitated by two divergent ideologies. Now, slavery does have something to do with what's going to happen in 1861. There's no doubt about it. But there's so many other things going on here, so many things that have built up to the sectional conflict, that what we're going to look at is that, you know, okay, is it only slavery that that caused this war, or were there other things? Were there underlying issues here that had never been resolved? I mean, really, you have to go all the way back to the early colonial period to start looking at these things. But, and we have talked about some of them, but what's going to happen in the 1850s is what one historian called the blundering generation, just kind of blundered into this war. There have been compromises between the sections. Things have been smoothed over at times, but now we're in the third generation of Americans, perhaps even the fourth generation of Americans in some ways, who are in the government. And these generations are not as attached to the original union of the founders as the founders were, even the second generation, or perhaps even parts of the third generation. So, this is a really important time period. It's going to take us a little while to get through the material. It's probably the most important time period in this entire section of the course in some ways. I mean, outside of the founding. You go from the founding and then you have to go to the 1850s and talk about how this war, came about, in terms of important periods in American history. And of course, this will all lead up to secession in 1860 and 1861. So we're in the final phases of it. We've had the sectional conflict. We've seen how this stuff has worked out from, say, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. Then, of course, we've seen how the sectional conflict played out in things like the Missouri Compromise. We've seen how it's played out in other issues like nullification. I'm sure you've looked at secession in other times in American history besides, or at least the discussion of secession besides 1860 and 61. So really, what must be said is that when 1861 rolls around and people start talking about secession, 1860 and people start talking about secession, it wasn't new. In fact, secession is going to be discussed a number of times even before it actually happens in 1860 and 61 in the 1850s. So, it's not like people were shocked that this idea was floating around there. And again, this is political. There's a political battle. Who's going to control the destiny of the United States? Will it be the Northeast or will it be the South? And of course, the South is very much starting to feel marginalized by the late 1840s and 1850s. Now, of course, we have to start with the 1848 election. That really is the beginning of the 1850s. And of course, at the end of the Mexican War, I already discussed in the last presentation the Wilmot Proviso, and of course we have the Mexican Cession. So we have all this territory that's going to be brought into the Union, and that's going to play a role in the 1848 election. Now the Democrats are going to nominate a man named Lewis Cass of Michigan for president, and this actually sets a trend. This is the first time the Democrats in a number of years have nominated a Northerner for president. The last time was Martin Van Buren, and of course he was Jackson's handpicked successor. But if you look at the Democrat Party from this to this point, it's dominated by Southerners, and they know they're going to get the South. So what the Democrats believe they can do here is nominate a Northerner and pull enough Northern votes away to make sure they win the election. Now, Lewis Cass has got a great reputation. He's served in the government in a number of capacities. He was a war hero, served in the War of 1812. So he's got a good reputation. On the other hand, the Whigs will nominate a guy that has a better reputation, Zachary Taylor of Louisiana. Now, here is the key for the Whigs. They're looking at the scene, the political scene. They're saying, okay, we won in 1840 when we nominated a war hero, William Henry Harrison. 1844, we nominated our best politician, so to speak, Henry Clay. That didn't work out for us. So 1848, we're dusting off our old playbook. We're going back to the war hero, and we're going to get Taylor. Most importantly, Taylor's from the South. And, of course, the Whigs are generally strongest in the North. So they're looking at a guy that's from the South to pull Southern votes. So each party is trying to think of itself as a truly national party at this point. And they both were. They both had candidates from different sections. They both had support in all states in the Union. That's not going to be the case when we get to the 1850s and we start talking about purely sectional parties. So Zachary Taylor is going to be nominated. Of course, old, rough, and ready, the hero of the Battle of Buena Vista, the guy that was, you know, single-handedly out there defeating the Mexican army early on in the war. This guy has got a reputation, and it's going to play a role in this election, his reputation as a war hero. Now, on the other hand, this is the first election in which we are going to have a somewhat of an anti-slavery party play a role in the election, and it's called the Free Soil Party. Now, the Free Soil Party was not an abolitionist party. It was an anti-slavery party in the sense that they wanted to prevent the extension of slavery into this newly acquired Western territory. That is the key, and I think most Americans don't realize this. Anti-slavery in the 1840s and 50s, for many Americans, not all, you have some ardent abolitionists out there that had some moral qualms about slavery, but anti-slavery was really anti-slavery extension. What they didn't want to do is see slavery extend into any new territory. They wanted to confine it to the South. And the Free Soil Party is going to be pretty smart here. They're going to nominate Martin Van Buren, a former president, a guy that had a great acumen for organizing political parties. So this guy's out there as the Free Soil candidate. And he's going to get a significant number of votes in this election. Now, what's important to note about this is that Lewis Cass believed in something called popular sovereignty. And we're going to talk about popular sovereignty a number of times. And this is the first time that you really see it on the national stage, so to speak, where you have a candidate for president talking about popular sovereignty. So what is popular sovereignty? It's one of the most important terms we're going to see in the 1850s. Now, the Mexican Cession is out there, and we've got all this land out west, California, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, all that territory now is open to the United States. So, how do we organize it? I already mentioned the Wilmot Proviso in 1846. There was an attempt to exclude slavery from this particular territory. The political solution, which was advanced by people like Lewis Cass and then later Stephen Douglas, was to say, let's let the people decide if it's going to be free soil or slave, meaning the people that settle in the territory. Let's let them decide. They'll move out there. They'll determine if slavery is viable or not. If more people believe that slavery is not viable, it won't be slave territory. If more people believe it is, it will be. So the idea was to just let the people decide, and that way it's off the table of Congress. We don't have to worry about this issue. We'll just take it as it comes. If the people want to form a slave state, they can. If they want to form a free soil state, they can do that too. Again, this is a political solution because it doesn't handle the underlying problems here. It ignores, at least this is what Southerners say, it ignores the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And we're going to see how important that Fifth Amendment is as we move forward into the 1850s. The Fifth Amendment, of course, will say that the federal government cannot deny an individual their life, their liberty, or their property without due process. And what Southerners are saying is if we take our slaves into this territory and you say we can't have them, then you're denying us our property without due process. So that's very important. Slaves, of course, it's hard for us to imagine in the 21st century that humans were in bondage and people were slaves. But what they're saying is these people are our property. It'd be no different to them for us today as, say, taking your car into the territory. And yeah, you can't have a car. So they're saying this is our labor. This is our labor force. This is our property. If we want to take our slaves into the territory and then you say we can't, you're denying us our property without due process. It's a very powerful legal argument. Of course, on the other hand, Northerners are saying, well, we regulate the territory. So therefore, we can regulate what's in the territory. Now, a state is another issue, but we regulate the territory. So again, we had the Wilmot Proviso, which is important. Now, John C. Calhoun saw this coming, and I think we have to go back to what he said in 1847. Now, this is the 1848 election. Of course, popular sovereignty now is on the table. Detractors actually called it squatter sovereignty. They just didn't like the idea of it. You know, you just go in and squat there, and whoever's there first determines what's going to happen in that territory. John C. Calhoun saw what was going to come out of this. He saw what was going to happen with his Mexican Cession. And in 1847, when he was in the Senate of the United States, he proposed something called the Calhoun Resolutions. This is what they're often called. He made this wonderful speech on the issue. And he said, look, the U.S. territory is common property of the United States. Okay, so all the states hold this territory in common. That means the state of Alabama or the state of South Carolina holds the territory just like the state of Massachusetts or the state of Connecticut or the state of New York or the state of Pennsylvania. They all hold the property together. And because of that, all states had access to the territory and all the people of the states had access to the territory. So people of the South have access to the territory just like people of the North. The only government requirement, the only constitutional requirement, I should say, for statehood was a Republican form of government. There was no other requirement. The federal government cannot place another requirement on becoming a state. As long as it has a Republican form of government, as long as the people organize it, and it has a suitable population and government, then it should be able to become a state. This is a very strong legal argument again. Calhoun also said something very prophetic in this particular speech and series of resolutions. He said, if the political balance between the North and South were destroyed, and he's talking about, of course, the number of free states to the number of slave states. We saw in other compromises that there would be the same number of free states as slave states. If that political balance were destroyed, and the reason why they wanted that, of course, is because that maintained a balance in the Senate. It gave the South a role in the Electoral College. So the South still had some control of this general government. If that balance was destroyed, it would produce, these were his words, political revolution, civil war, and widespread disaster. He's saying this in 1847, 14 years before the war begins. Very prophetic. Calhoun had said these things also when Michigan was admitted as a state. He was perfectly fine. And this is generally the Southern position. People don't realize this. Most Southerners were perfectly fine with states coming into the Union as free states, as long as that's what the people wanted. Once a state is a state, it can do what it wants. The rub was the territory. If you are saying that we cannot take our property into the common property of the United States, the states, the people of the states hold that property. If you're saying we can't take our slaves into that territory, you are denying our Fifth Amendment rights. You're denying our rights under the Constitution to life, liberty, and property, and not being able to seize that without due process. And again, this is federal territory. It has nothing to do with the states. The states can do what they want. If the state of Massachusetts wants to abolish slavery, that's all up to them, or the state of Michigan, or the state of Pennsylvania. But if the state of South Carolina wants to have slavery, well, that's their business too. And under the original Constitution, that's how it worked. That's how everyone understood it in 1787 and 1788. But it seems that over time, the North had taken a different slant. And why did they want to do this? Again, it's because they wanted that power, that political control. Okay, so what's going to happen here is rather interesting. We're going to get another compromise. We had the Missouri Compromise of 1820. And of course, what the Missouri Compromise of 1820 did, just to kind of recap, it prohibited slavery south of the southern border of Missouri, 3630. Prohibited slavery north of the southern border of Missouri, excuse me, and allowed slavery south of the southern border of Missouri. It also brought Missouri in as a slave state and Maine as a free state to maintain that balance. Okay, so really all that did was open up the current states of Oklahoma and Arkansas to slavery, and it left everything north of that, which is a huge chunk of territory in 1820, closed to slavery, made all that area closed to slavery, left it as free soil territory. Okay, so that's the recap. So we haven't had a compromise on this territorial issue since 1820 because there was really no use. We hadn't acquired any more territory. Now we've got the Mexican Cession. Now we have a battle brewing again. You've got Lewis Cass saying popular sovereignty. Stephen Douglas of Illinois, who we'll talk a lot about, saying popular sovereignty. The South saying, if you prohibit our slaves from that territory, well, you're denying our Fifth Amendment rights. The North saying, we regulate the territory, so therefore we can regulate what's in the territory. So there has to be some type of solution here. And again, what we're going to get in 1850 is another political solution. Political solutions are very bad things oftentimes because they don't really solve anything. They just create more problems. This was a constitutional crisis in so many ways. Who had the better argument in terms of the Constitution? This was a political economic crisis. It was a, when we talk about a sectional crisis, these two sections, the South and the North, had been antagonistic since before the United States was even created, put together during the American War for Independence. The North and the South had long been antagonistic. So the Compromise of 1850 is hammered out. Again, Henry Clay is going to be involved, the great compromiser. This is, he's on his last legs. You know, he and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun, that great triumvirate, as they're often called, they were all near death at this point, just a couple of years away for each. Calhoun's actually going to die in 1850. Webster and Clay just a couple of years later. President Zachary Taylor is going to oppose any congressional action on the slavery question, but he supports the admission of California as a free state. So California has already got enough people to have a state, to declare statehood, and he supports the admission of California as a free state. Now, this kind of shocks Southerners in a way. Zachary Taylor's a slaveholder. He's from Louisiana. And they're thinking, hey, yeah, we got a Southerner in there, and he's going to support us. But he's listening to a lot of Northerners at this time. And instead of supporting the Southern position, he just says, look, we don't need to discuss this issue. However, fortunately for, say, the advocates of popular sovereignty, Zachary Taylor will die in office. And it's a very interesting story how that happens. He goes to a 4th of July celebration. And of course, this is the 1850s. It's actually 1850 itself. And he doesn't wear his t-shirt, flip-flops, and shorts to this 4th of July celebration. It's in Washington, D.C. And of course, if you've ever been to Washington, D.C. in the summer, it's extremely hot. It's in a swamp. It's below sea level in some points. It's hot. And he wears his full suit, overcoat, and top hat to this very, very hot 4th of July celebration. And he dies of heat stroke. So Zachary Taylor now will be the second president to die in office. Obviously, if you're a Whig and you're elected president, it's hazardous to your health, because here we have another one biting the dust as the chief executive of the United States. And so now the presidency will go to the illustrious Millard Fillmore of New York. Not a very presidential name, and Millard Fillmore has been lost to time. He was a Whig, but he's lost to time, because if you want to talk about a presidency with really nothing to talk about in terms of what Fillmore actually did or didn't do, it's the Fillmore administration outside the Compromise of 1850. Okay, so that's pretty much it for Millard Fillmore. Now, in 1850, there was talk of Southern secession again. Southerners are starting to say in 1850, well, they had talked about it in the 1830s, at least South Carolina did during the nullification crisis. And here they are talking about it in 1850. Now, of course, Northerners had talked about it openly in, say, 1799, 1803, 1804, 1814, 1815. Now here Southerners are talking about it in 1850. Why? Because they're saying, look, if they're going to prohibit slavery extension, then we're sunk. And why were they worried about this? A lot of people would say, well, they're worried about losing their slaves in the southern states. No, not really. Northerners are saying over and over, we're not going to abolish slavery in South Carolina or Alabama or Mississippi. We're not worried about that. You can have slavery there. What they're worried about, what Southerners are worried about, is controlling the government. They know if they lose this battle, they have no way to control the government. Just like in 1799 and 1803 and 1804 and 1814, 15, Northerners were worried about the exact same thing. This is power politics at its best. So, Southerners are saying, look, we're out of here, okay? We can't control this government. We can't make sure that our rights and property are going to be secured by a government dominated by a different section. So we'll just leave the Union. Well, Henry Clay, again, the great compromiser, is going to work out a compromise. It's called the Compromise of 1850. California will come into the Union as a free state. So the North will actually have a stronger role in the Senate than the South through this compromise. However, Clay will hammer out that the new territory in the Mexican Cession outside of California will be organized under popular sovereignty. Okay, so you're talking about the Utah and New Mexico territory. Huge tract of land. That's going to be organized under popular sovereignty. Well, that sounds pretty good. Okay, but I'll talk about what Southerners are saying about that in a second. They buy it, but there's some trepidation there. Also, the slave trade will be prohibited in Washington, D.C., trying to give a bone to the North, and you will get a stronger fugitive slave law, supposedly a bone to the South. The South had complained for years that escaped slaves were not being returned. So, how did people look at this thing? I mean, here he is, the great compromiser, the great negotiator, the great deal maker, Henry Clay. He had tried to make deals to become president. He had made deals before. Here he is. He made deals in the nullification crisis. Here he is trying to make another deal. Calhoun, who's very close to death at this point, he has tuberculosis and he's dying. He's actually going to die in Washington, D.C., will insist that the only way to preserve the Union is to give the South equal access to the territories. It's the only way to preserve the Union. If you don't do that, he's saying in 1850, we're done. The Union might as well be gone, because you know what? What you're doing here is prohibiting the South their equal rights in this Union. And remember, Calhoun had said at one time, the Union next to our liberty most dear. We can only preserve it, and I'm paraphrasing here, by distributing equally the benefits and burdens of Union. So if we're not doing that, we're not preserving the Union. Okay? If one side is, one section is benefiting more than the other, that's not a Union. That's a government for one section and against another. Daniel Webster of Massachusetts is going to support the compromise, primarily because he doesn't think slavery is viable in the Southwest. And if you think about it, it really wasn't. There are very few slaves. I'll talk about this in a little while. There are very few slaves in the Southwest, even in 1861, in areas that you could possibly have slaves. I mean, hardly any there. We were talking about the desert. It's kind of hard to grow cotton in the desert. Now, of course, you could have had some form of slavery, but it's not going to be the plantation-style agriculture that we have in the rest of the southern states. I mean, this is really a rhetorical issue. The South knows they're not going to get a whole lot of slaves out of this, but at least they would have equal access to the territories. Now, what's interesting about this, Daniel Webster supports the compromise, and he's going to go back up to Boston, and he's going to start rounding up fugitive slaves. And he takes a lot of heat for this, but he says, look, we signed the deal, we agreed to it, so therefore, we're going to follow it. That's the way to save the Union. If we don't, we might as well just be kicking the South right now, because we're saying, ha, 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 we got you, we signed the deal, now we're going to kick you. So Webster is saying here, we have to support this compromise if we sign it. Of course, Henry Clay made an impassioned speech for the compromise to save the Union, but the most important speech was not from Webster, Clay, or Calhoun, the great triumvirate. The most important speech was made by a guy named William H. Seward, a politician from New York. And the title of this speech is The Higher Law Speech. And this speech is shocking, shocking the Southerners. Because essentially what Seward is saying in The Higher Law Speech is, look, there's a higher law than the Constitution, and that higher law should be followed. Well, Southerners are saying, my gosh, if what we're saying now in 1850, there's a higher law than the Constitution, there's a law outside of the Constitution, what the heck do we have the Constitution for? Why do we want to be in this Union? If we can't say to you, well, the Constitution says X, Y, and Z, and this is what we should do, you're going to say, well, okay, but there's a higher law than that. What's going to happen? I mean, how can we guarantee that anything that we want is protected? How can we guarantee that we have a constitutional government anymore? You can just say any law is legal because there's a higher law than that, than the Constitution. This is terrifying. And a lot of Northerners pick up on it too. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What are you saying, Seward? Wait a second here. There's no higher law than the Constitution. It's the law that governs, it's the document that governs the general government of the United States. There's no higher law than that. You can't say there is. But Seward's saying there is. And he's going to be a very important individual because he's going to be one of these founders of something called the Republican Party later on. And people are terrified of this Republican Party. Now, after the compromise passes, and it will pass, Northern and Southern radicals were defeated at the polls. There were a few pockets here, for example, in Eufaula, Alabama, that secessionist sentiment was still very strong in the South. In the North, there are still a few pockets of radical abolitionism or people who are not happy about it. But really the only radical elected to any position in the general government at this point was Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. And Charles Sumner of Massachusetts is going to be important in the 1850s and the 1860s, as we'll see. Okay, so the compromise passes. We've got Northern and Southern radicals defeated at the polls, but this didn't necessarily mean the issue's over. It's not dead. In fact, in the North, Northerners generally didn't like this thing. Why? Because of the Fugitive Slave Law. And they think this Fugitive Slave Law is going a little bit too far. So, in fact, in many northern states, you're going to start seeing things called personal liberty laws. Personal liberty laws. And these personal liberty laws said essentially this. I don't care what you said in Congress. I don't care that you said we have this compromise and we have the stronger fugitive slave law. I don't care about that. We're voiding that. We're nullifying it. Personal liberty laws were nullification. So here you have the North dusting off nullification. Oftentimes this issue of nullification is seen as something that the South, these mean, horned, detailed Southerners do to preserve slavery. Well, here you have Northerners dusting off nullification and saying, you know what? We can use nullification too. We don't like your fugitive slave law, and so we're going to nullify it. So nullification cuts both ways. Of course, Southerners never used it to defend slavery. But nullification cuts both ways. Southerners can use it, and Northerners can use it too. There's an issue with this, though. Southerners say this move is unconstitutional. And they kind of have a point. When Southerners use nullification, when they nullified the Sedition Act in 1798, Jefferson and Madison, the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions, when South Carolina nullified the tariff in 1832, they were saying those laws were unconstitutional. The North isn't saying these laws are unconstitutional, really. They can't, because the fugitive slave law is in the Constitution. In fact, the Supreme Court's going to rule that way at one point, that you can't nullify something in the Constitution itself. A protective tariff, not in the Constitution. A Sedition Act, unconstitutional because of the First Amendment. Fugitive slave law, it's in the Constitution. Kind of hard to nullify that. But it's important to note that Northerners are actually using this thing too, this thing called nullification. It's not just a Southern idea, it's an American idea. Resistance to strong central authority is an American tradition. Central authority, strong central authority, is not an American tradition. Resistance to it is. Okay, so that's an important theme overall in American history. But what you're starting to see here, what Southerners are starting to say is, my gosh, we've just passed this compromise of 1850. We did this in good faith. Y'all got a free state out of this. We didn't really get anything. We didn't get squat. What we get? Popular sovereignty in Utah and New Mexico? Big deal. We can't take our slaves out there and grow cotton in the desert. So all we really got was a stronger fugitive slave law. And a lot of times, Southerners didn't even try to go out and get their slaves anyways, but they did complain about it. And now you're going to nullify it? That sounds like Northern aggression to me. You're being aggressive. You're not holding up your part. You're not holding up your end of the bargain. Why do we want to be in this union? These are important issues. So in 1852, we're going to have another election cycle. The Whigs, dusting off the old playbook again, will say, hey, let's see. We had a general in 1840. He was elected. We had a general in 1848. He was elected. We have any other generals out there? Oh, yeah, Winfield Scott, old Fuss and Feathers, the guy that won the Battle of Veracruz, the guy that took Mexico City. He's a Whig. Let's nominate that guy. So they're going to get another Southern general as their nominee. And, of course, Winfield Scott is Southern. He's from Virginia. So they're following their plan of 1840 and 1848. Democrats do the exact same thing. They're going to say, okay, we need a Northerner. We need some guy that's got a good reputation. Well, we got this guy named Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire. New Hampshire, great northern state. And he has a pretty good reputation. He served in the Mexican War. So, you know, he's got this military background. We're going to nominate Franklin Pierce. And Franklin Pierce, of course, is a guy that supports every traditional element of the Democrat Party. Whether it's low tariffs, no funding for internal improvements, supports southern rights in the territories. So Franklin Pierce appears to be a perfect candidate. And what really happens here is that this 52 election comes down to personalities. Winfield Scott's nickname, Old Fuss and Feathers, says something about him. This is a guy who reportedly threw a checkerboard when a kid beat him in checkers. Who's going to want to elect that guy for president? So Franklin Pierce, he's a good guy. Everyone likes Franklin Pierce. He gets elected. It's a pretty close election. But you know what? Pierce is going to win. The Free Soil Party did run a candidate, a guy named J.P. Hale, but again, not really much of a factor in this particular election. Now, the Pierce administration is going to come down to territory. Acquiring more territory. He appoints a lot of Southerners to his cabinet, most importantly Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, who's Secretary of War. And Davis of Mississippi has an interest in a Southern Transcontinental Railroad. So, of course, Northerners had an interest in one, too. It was the race to see who could get that Transcontinental Railroad was part of the, you know, driving factor in organizing this territory. Was it going to be a Southern route or a Northern route? Or will we have two routes, a Southern and a Northern route? So territory is going to be important. So we have that. We also have things called filibusters going on this period. Now, you think a filibuster, oh, yeah, Senate. No, not that. Something else called a military filibuster. And we're going to talk about that. Pierce was often seen as a puppet by Northerners. This guy's just a puppet. He's doing whatever the South wants. He really doesn't care about the Constitution. He doesn't care about anything to save the Union. He just wants to support and appease Southerners. Now, nothing can be further from the truth. Franklin Pierce is an interesting guy, though, when we get to the 1860s. This is a guy that essentially hated the cause of the North, saving the Union. He said, look, let's just let the South go peacefully. Why do we need to fight these guys? You said for years you didn't like them. Let them leave. Why are we fighting a war over this? So he was an ardent supporter of the South from New Hampshire between 1861 and 1865. Now, we'll talk about this slave power and what this means. It's this idea of the slave power. Now, it's during the Pierce administration we're going to pick up the final piece of the Southwest in something called the Gadsden Purchase. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, again, wanting to have a Southern Transcontinental Railroad, has to get this piece of land, because if you don't have this piece of land in the Southwest, you can't get there. You can't get from, say, the South to the coast of California via a railroad. The other area is just too hard to build a railroad. So we're going to buy a little more territory from Mexico. We pay essentially almost the same amount we paid for the entire Mexican cession for this little chunk of territory in the Southwest. And that's the last chunk of territory we buy in the lower 48 in American history. So we've got more territory, okay, in the continental United States. And then we have these things called filibusters, military filibusters. You have guys out there that are going into places like South America, and they are breaking off portions of South American, pieces of South America, and creating these independent republics. And what Northerners said was happening here, is that these little pieces of these little independent republics, Southerners want these things, because it's Southerners who are primarily doing this. They want these things. What they want is to extend the United States all the way down into the Caribbean, into Mexico, wherever they can go. They're just going to keep on trying to acquire more and more territory in the South, because they want to extend slavery. The thing is, these little pieces of territory that were broken off, there's a guy named Walker who was doing a lot of this stuff. Southerners really had no interest in acquiring these things. Walker was doing this on his own. He was very unsuccessful in terms of getting the United States to buy into it. He ultimately would be killed doing this. But Northerners have their gotcha moment with Cuba. Now, Cuba had long been a design of the United States. It's right off the coast of Florida. It's a natural extension of the United States in so many ways. Why don't we just buy this big island out there and make it part of our territory? Well, it's during this Pierce administration, you have something called the Ostend Manifesto circulate around. This thing is supposed to be secret, but it gets out. And essentially what had happened here is that there were a couple of Southerners and a Northerner, James Buchanan, who will be president, Pierre Soulé and John Slidell. They're interested in acquiring this particular island, and the idea was to buy it for $120 million. So if we could buy Cuba from Spain for $120 million, we were going to do it. Of course, the plan falls apart, but it's important to note that the Ostend Manifesto was an attempt to purchase more territory in the South. And again, it's the gotcha moment for the North. Aha! There, we got you. You're trying to buy this slave territory. We know, because of course Cuba had slavery, we know what you're trying to do here. And there it is. There's the slave power at work. So what you're going to start hearing is this term, that slave power, thrown around out there. What is the slave power? Well, the idea was that, of course, you had these Southerners out there trying to extend their power, slave power. These slave owners are trying to extend their power and authority in this government, and we've got to stop it. And they had another gotcha moment in 1854. In 1854, a Northerner named Stephen Douglas, he's from Illinois, a senator from Illinois, is going to propose to organize part of the old Louisiana Purchase under popular sovereignty. Now, wait a second here. Missouri Compromise of 1820, this area is supposed to be off limits to slavery. Stephen Douglas says, forget that compromise. That's old news. We've got popular sovereignty in the Mexican cession. Let's just apply it to the rest of the territory, common property of the United States. And so he wants to organize Kansas and Nebraska under popular sovereignty. Now, Douglas has a couple of reasons for wanting to do this. Number one, He's got a financial stake in it. He wants to build a transcontinental railroad across this area. He's got land there. He wants to do this. Okay, wants to get that transcontinental railroad. So he's going to make a lot of money if he can organize his territory. The other thing, Douglas wants to be president. Remember, he's from a northern state. The Democrat Party is nominating northerners. From 1848, Lewis Cass, 1852, Franklin Pierce. He thinks, 1856, that could be my year. I think I'll go with popular sovereignty to try to get these southerners to support me. And he gets some support out of this. Okay, so, but he's trashing the Missouri Compromise. And northerners, oh my goodness, they go berserk over this stuff. Wait a second here. We have the Missouri Compromise. Here it is, the slave power at work again. The slave power. These people are out there trying to extend slavery in areas where we said it would never exist. Here's the slave power. I mean, here it is. Prime example of it. So this rhetorical issue, the slave power, they just start hammering this thing. Bam, bam. Just start beating the Americans over the head with it, particularly Western farmers. Western farmers aren't necessarily interested in seeing slavery extension in this territory because it's competition. Okay, so they just start hammering this thing on the American public. The slave power, the slave power, the slave power, the slave power. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. If you say it enough, boom, 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 people are going to believe it. And it starts working. Okay, so Southerners were interested in extension. Okay, there's no doubt about it. Southerners wanted to be able to bring their property into the common property of the United States, but they had a very sound legal argument why they should be able to do that. And of course, they had this idea of, you know, we need to maintain a balance. Northerners knew the exact same thing. It's why they agitated in Missouri in 1820 anyways. It was the same issue. We need to preserve our political economy. We need to preserve our power in this union. Okay? So what's going to happen? Well, the Kansas-Nebraska Act is going to go through. It's going to be signed into law by Franklin Pierce. And it's going to become part of the process in organizing these territories. Well, the results are disastrous in so many ways. This is why, again, Avery Craven called this group of people, like Stephen Douglas, the blundering generation. Because it's blunder left and right. They make stupid decisions. The compromises that have been put in place before were working fine. Now he says, the Missouri Compromise, that's gone. This thing supersedes it. Now, Southerners hated the Missouri Compromise. Don't get me wrong. They hated that thing. This thing, he says, supersedes it. So they're happier with popular sovereignty, but they want something more. Okay. But again, Northerners, boom, boom, slave power, slave power, slave power, slave power. So they keep hammering this thing, and it's going to break apart our national party system, this Kansas-Nebraska Act. It's disastrous. You actually have a group of Democrats issue a statement called an Appeal of Independent Democrats. And again, they start hammering this thing, the slave power in this, and they start ridiculing the South. They start ridiculing the fact that many Northerners are starting to support a Southern position. They call them doughfaces. And they appeal to Democrats to say, look, we need to make sure that we don't ruin true democracy in their mind. Now, the issue here became two things. Containment over expansion. Containment versus expansion. Northerners, for the most part, really didn't care about the plight of slaves. Did they like slavery? No. Did they think it was a good thing? No. But they really didn't care about Southerners owning slaves, as long as it stayed in the 15 states of the South. Outside of that, they could care less. Now, if it starts expanding, ooh, then you got a problem. Okay, so again, some of this is about political power, no doubt about it. But it also comes down to other things. This is what they said in this appeal of independent Democrats. This is a direct quote. We want them, meaning the territories, for the homes of free white people. They don't even want blacks living there. There's a great book written by a guy named Leon Litvak, and it's called North of Slavery. I would highly recommend it, because what he does is take apart this self-righteous northern argument that we are good and whole, we don't like slavery, we're good people. He takes it apart and shows that places in the north, like Indiana, and at times Ohio, Illinois, had severe laws against blacks even living in those states. So one abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, actually called this particular idea white manism. And we're going to talk about that with the Republican Party, okay? But here you have it. They directly say it. We don't want slavery in these territories because we want this for the homes of free white people. That's all we're concerned about. Free white people. We don't want the competition from slavery. We don't want black people living there. We want it open for free white people only. Southerners are saying, look, we don't care if black people are out there. They're part of the South. You know, move them out there all we want. Southerners then will point to exaggerated claims in this appeal and solidify their opposition to what they call Northern aggression. Here it is, another example. Here's Northern aggression. So you have the North saying, boom, boom, slave power, slave power, slave power. And now you have the South saying, Northern aggression, Northern aggression, Northern aggression. Boom, boom. These things are just going to start beating against each other. The North's being aggressive. The South has the slave power. That's how crazy it gets. But again, this slave power had a profound rhetorical effect because it's actually going to lead to the formation of a new political party, purely sectional in nature. There are no Republicans in the South. In fact, when we get to 1860 and we start talking about Abraham Lincoln, he wasn't even on the ballot in the South. So it's a purely sectional party. Very powerful, though. And again, this is the modern Republican Party. It's formed in 1854 and it's still around. It's actually formed in Wisconsin, and they had a very interesting slogan: free soil, free labor, free men. A Marxist historian named Eric Foner wrote a wonderful book about the formation of the Republican Party, and that's the title of the book, Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men. Now, Eric Foner is not good for much else, but this book is pretty good. Okay. Again, William Lloyd Garrison called this white manism. White manism. Because what they're trying to do, if you take this out, if you add in what they really thought, it was free soil, free white labor, free white men. Free soil for free white men. No slavery, no competition for jobs from blacks at all, whether it's free blacks or slaves. They didn't want them there. Also, another important plank of the Republican platform is the adoption of the Hamiltonian slash American system. These people wanted to perpetuate this American system, this Hamiltonianism that had been around since 1791. They're cutting a deal. They're cutting a deal here with Western farmers. The deal is simple. We'll give you homestead legislation so you can go settle out there and get your free soil for your free white men and your free white labor. We'll give you that. In return, you vote for our tariffs. You vote for our federally funded internal improvements. You vote for our bank. There's the deal. And they bought it. And when we get to the populist era, I know Dr. Woods will talk about the populist era in so many ways, and I'll mention this again when we talk about Reconstruction. In so many ways, the populists are the group of people that wake up and think, oh my gosh, we just cut the wrong deal. We sided with the wrong people. We cut a deal back in the 1850s with these northern state capitalists, these guys out there who want this Hamiltonian system, and they're just robbing us blind. So the populist party and the populist movement pops up. These are farmers who realize they've gotten the raw end of the deal. They've gotten the raw deal instead of the square deal or the new deal. They've gotten the raw deal. Okay. And the American public got the raw deal. John Taylor of Caroline said the exact same thing long before, if we don't listen to him. Now, the Republican Party is basically made up of free soilers, know-nothings, which are also called the American Party, and Northern Whigs and Democrats. Again, you're not going to find a Southerner in it. Now, I mentioned this before, we talked about why slavery. I've already kind of discussed this a little bit, but this is a political economic conflict. The Southerners tend to support a Jeffersonian way of life, agrarianism, resistance to centralization, a distrust of big business and big government, really more importantly, a fusion of big banks, organized finance and government. They really don't want that because that destroys their interests. So you have this Jeffersonian political economy against this Hamiltonian system. Well, Hamiltonianism likes promotion of commerce, industry, and finance. It loves the corruption of government, fusion of government and banking. Loves this stuff. In fact, Hamilton invented it. The corruption makes everything beautiful. It makes it to where I can make you dependent on me. And so he loved these things. This is one of the main reasons why slavery becomes so important, because generally, Southern slaveholders are going to support this Jeffersonian system. Not all. But generally they do. And of course you have Northerners who support it too. Were there moral concerns about slaves? Sure. There were abolitionists in the Republican Party. There were those that thought slavery was a moral evil and should be eradicated. But for the most part, most Republicans were not that. Most Republicans were just people who were interested in keeping slavery confined in the South, containing it, and cutting this deal with Western farmers so they could get what they wanted out of their political economic system. They could control the government. They could centralize authority. Even the Free Soil Party of 1848 and 1852 pushed a limited Hamiltonian system because they recognized what this was. This was a battle over political economy. And again, that alliance between the West and the North is very, very important. Henry Clay realized it back when he came up with the American system, that Western farmers wanted things like internal improvements at times, and they're going to want homestead legislation. And so he cuts the deal with Northerners thinking, yeah, we can get that, you can get yours, and we'll all be happy. Southerners are generally opposed to this stuff. And John C. Calhoun realizes at one point and actually told his Southern buddies, hey, look, if we want to save off being destroyed here, we better start supporting some things like maybe some internal improvements, start maybe looking at that stuff, because we're going to be in trouble if we don't. Of course, the South was opposed to these kind of things. Again, it's all about who controls the spoils. Now, a union, as Calhoun said, should benefit all and burden all equally. It just wasn't by the 1850s. The Southerners didn't think it was benefiting them at all, and Northerners thought it was benefiting them tremendously. And they wanted to keep it that way. So Southerners are going to leave this government in 1861 because it doesn't benefit them anymore. What's the point? They have no access to the territories, really. At least Northerners want it that way. They don't have any control of the government. They don't have any control of the political economy. At least this is what they think by the time we get to 1861. Again, legal issues. As I mentioned this before, the Southern defense of slavery in the territories and slavery extension rested on the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. If you prohibit slavery in the territories, you prohibit their rights under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. So they want to make sure that their rights to the slave territory or to the territory is maintained through the Fifth Amendment. If you don't allow us to bring our property into this territory, you're denying us our property without due process. Northerners counted that because they controlled, Congress controlled the territories, they organized the territories, they in turn could regulate slavery, and they pointed to things like the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, where slavery was prohibited under the Articles of Confederation, but slavery was prohibited in that territory. Now, the key to that, though, is very important here. Northerners will dust off the Northwest Ordinance all the time. Yeah. What about your guy, Jefferson, saying we can't have slavery in the territories? That was your guy. He's a Southerner. Jefferson also said the states had equal rights that came into the Union. So if they wanted to have slavery, they could. Northerners would deny that. Okay. And they would deny it in practice. And they denied it in fact, de facto denied it when we get to Kansas. Northerners were not having any of it. Okay. So Jefferson would have said, well, if Indiana wanted to be a slave state, fine. Of course, slavery is not in the territories. The chances of that happening are pretty slim. But if Indiana wanted to, as an equal state, an equal sister state, they could do that, just like the state of Massachusetts can abolish slavery if they want to. So the states were equal under the Constitution. Okay, every state was equal in the Union. That's how Jefferson viewed it. States were sister states. There were no original 13 and then everything else. The states were all equal. This is a firm argument for secession as well. The states, once they become a state, are equal, because Jefferson said they were in 1787, any states carved out of this territory, they're equal with the other original states. Just because they came out of the common property of the United States doesn't mean anything. And of course, they can go back to the Declaration. If you say they're not equal, then we shouldn't have any states in the 13 original states either, because we were all part of British territory at one time. And they created states out of that. So therefore, out of our territory, we should be able to create states too that are equal with the original states. This argument that they're not is hogwash, is bunk, is stupidity, really. Because you have to think about how the states came about to begin with. They were out of British common property. So, you organize a territory and then you organize a state out of that territory. And that state has equal status with the original states. If that state wants to have slavery, they can. Northerners would deny this and they would prevent it. Everything they could to prevent it in the 1850s. Southerners say, enough. We just can't, we have no role in this government. Now, the organization of the Kansas-Nebraska Territory is going to lead to something called Bleeding Kansas. This is what I was just referring to. Northerners called it Bleeding Kansas. Civil War in Kansas. This is, again, a rhetorical issue. What's going to happen is once you have Kansas and Nebraska organized, you're going to get people moving into Kansas. Kansas was going to be the first area that was going to be organized and first area that would probably become a state. Of course, Kansas is right next to Missouri, and it's just south of Iowa. And you're going to have people flooding into Kansas from both Missouri and then from Iowa as well. Charles Sumner is going to say that Missourians who settled in Kansas were hirelings picked from the drunken spew and vomit of an uneasy civilization. Think about what he's saying of Southerners. They're hirelings picked from the drunken spew and vomit of an uneasy civilization. This is what Charles Sumner of Massachusetts is saying about Southerners. And they're saying these Southerners are evil people and you know, the slave power. Northerners are saying, look at this guy. Look at what he's saying. Republicans instantly claim that civil war was erupting in Kansas, but was it? What you have here is quite interesting. You have Southerners moving in there. They saw, well, you know, we're right next to Missouri. We'll just move over into Kansas. But there's going to be a concerted effort on the part of New Englanders in particular to get Northerners into that territory. In fact, they have something called the New England Immigrant Aid Society. The idea was to pay people to settle in Kansas. So were Southerners the drunken hirelings or were Northerners the drunken hirelings? Of course, Northerners, the puritanical Northerners weren't drinking, but were they the drunken hirelings? They're the ones being hired to go into the territory. Not just that, you had people like Henry Ward Beecher out there. He's from the Beecher family, Harriet Beecher Stowe, etc., paying people or paying for guns to arm these people. They were called Beecher's Bibles. So we're going to not only send people in from the New England Immigrant Aid Society, we're going to make sure they're armed. Well, my gosh, who's really causing the Civil War in Kansas, if there was one to begin with? Well, there really wasn't that much fighting here. You had a sack of Lawrence. This is what Northerners pointed to all the time. Bleeding Kansas, the sack of Lawrence. Look at these evil Southerners out there just abusing these poor, free soil, anti-slavery people in Kansas. Well, what's happening here is pretty interesting. Lawrence is sacked. There's some property damage. And what actually happened is the property damage that was precipitated was actually brought on by the fact that one of the guys who owned a saloon in town in Lawrence was trying to appease the rioters, so to speak, the mob, and he gave them all drinks. These guys got all drunk, and then they started breaking stuff. There really wasn't much violence, though, in terms of bloodshed from the southern position. Now, Northerners, not so. This is when John Brown's going to make a name for himself, because John Brown hears about the sack of Lawrence, and he's going to go on the rampage. He's going to commit homicide. This is not a battle. It's often called the Battle of Pottawatomie Creek. There's no battle. It's John Brown going into the middle of the night into a slave owner's home and killing everybody there and hatching them up. This is a homicide. It's not a battle. A battle is fought between armies. There's no battle here. This is at the dead of the night. They didn't even know it was coming. That's a homicide. And that's what John Brown is famous for. Homicide. Mayhem. Of course, John Brown's going to have a lot of different opinions of him in the North eventually, but this guy is nothing more than a criminal. But again, Northerners, this is the slave power at work. Boom, 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 the slave power. Southerners saying, looking what Seward said, they're just drunk and spew and vomit. Okay, so, well, what are we here? We're lower than low. We're vomit. Southerners saying, Northerners are calling us vomit on the ground. Well, how's that going to work out for a union? In fact, Sumner's going to make a speech entitled The Crimes Against Kansas Speech in the Senate. He's going to offend Southerners, particularly Andrew Butler of South Carolina. Andrew Butler had a speech impediment, and Sumner's going to start lisping all through the speech and making fun of Andrew Butler. Well, Butler wasn't around to defend himself, but Butler's nephew was. His name was Preston Brooks, and he was a member of the House of Representatives. Preston Brooks is going to hear about this, and he's going to get a couple of guys together, and they're going to go, and they're going to block the Senate chamber. And at this time, senators worked at their desks. They didn't have these palatial offices and everything. But he's going to block the Senate chamber. He's going to go in and beat the tar out of Charles Sumner with a cane. He's going to whip him. Sumner and Massachusetts will leave the seat open in protest while Brooks is reelected by crushing majorities in the South and even sent canes from all over the South. You know, hit him again. If you go to the University of South Carolina today, the South Carolina Library, which is the oldest library on campus and one of the oldest freestanding libraries in the country, has a plaque dedicated to Preston Brooks at the beginning of as you walk in the library. Hit him again. So here you have, and of course, the Northern press picked up on this. It was Southern chivalry, what they're saying is Southern chivalry really is beating guys up. And of course, Charles Sumner is defending himself with a pen. Oh, you know, this is one of the drawings out there. The Northern press said this is brutality on the part of the Southerners. And they're saying these Southern people are not just vomit, they're brutal. Now you can see the images being portrayed here and the images being created all throughout the United States now of Southerners. You can see that this rhetorical effect is starting to really wear on both sides. The slave power, northern aggression, boom. And that's what we're going to get. Pick up with the 1856 election now.